Hi, it's Quinn, and you're listening to Not So Bloody Mary, the show about women in history with negative reputations. Enjoy the show!
Hey, Grace.
Hey, Quinn.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm tired.
Me too.
I didn't wake up until 10, but Henry, yesterday, did not wake up until a quarter after 1. So,
oh my.
Henry, if you're listening, we love you.
Oh, my.
He didn't wake up until a quarter after 1, yeah. And I was like, but let's not do that today. And he's like, I'm not going to. But anyways, yeah. I was outside this morning with Jordan in my pajamas because I woke up at 10. And then I didn't come downstairs until like 10:20. And then we went outside with her at like 10:40. And she was like, pajamas! And I'm like, yeah. Didn't change. Yeah, it was just great.
That's cute.
Love small children. They're actually like the best thing. Honestly, having her next door has probably been the best way to combat boredom. Because she never stops. She's always going. Yeah. She likes to. Are you still folding your laundry?
Yeah, I am, actually.
Look at Grace doing chores, everyone.
It's actually a lot of laundry, and
yeah.
I'm not motivated to do it unless, you know, this makes me be like, do your chores.
Well, yeah, I mean, I always do my chores and I listen to podcasts, so it works. I was listening to, this morning I was listening to Queen's podcast, but yesterday I was listening to You're Wrong About, and they were talking about Roe v. Wade. What a time. Yeah, I was trying to do it so that I would be, like, smart for my paper, but my paper was due on Friday, so I missed out on that because it's Sunday today. But whatever, it's fine.
Fine.
Fun. Well, I'm just, like, not feeling the going back to school tomorrow vibe.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah. I have English tomorrow. We're doing our novel study all week, which, like, doing a novel study in a week is not the move.
No.
Like, no. But we have to, so it's great. It's a really good book, though.
I'm just doing history. My teacher emailed me to ask me if she could use one of my things from her class last year as an example.
Last year?
Yeah.
Which teacher? You didn't have Miss history Howland. Last year.
No, I had her for NBE, though.
Okay. Yeah, I got asked if my English teacher could use my Cask of the Amontillado thing as an exemplar, and I was like, yeah, but I'm pretty sure it was really bad, so go ahead. Henry and I were just really confused because we got 100s on that project, but we haven't gotten that mark on other things, so we don't know what the difference was. Like, I don't know. I'm just so tired of online school.
Me too. But I don't want to go back at the same time.
No. I don't want to go back. The only reason I would want to go back would be to see my friends. But, like, I feel like my teachers, well, Miss Matchett would let us sit together. But I feel like my English teacher would not. I think she would have assigned seating, and then I'd just be sad.
I really don't want to go back for, Monday.
Yeah,
because I have a test on Monday, and I don't use notes.
Oh.
I don't write, and we're allowed, it's open book, but, like, I look back on the slides. I don't rewrite everything.
You don't write notes. Miss Matchett literally told us that she's like, you know, sometimes I'll just let you use your notes because you got to help a brother out. But then she said that if we were going back to school, she'll probably still just let us go through all of our notes for tests because it's surprising times. So I guess that's good because I'm not going to remember anything about the American government.
We don't have to memorize, like, anything for history.
Yeah, because you're not supposed to in, like, grade 10 history.
She's like,
we have
I'm
to
not gonna make you know any dates. We're not going to have
no, we don't do that. We don't
I was
do
like, I love
dates.
You.
We don't do dates in grade 10 history. That is not the vibe. But, no, we haven't really done any dates so far this year. But we do have to know the numbers for the Senate seats and the House of Representatives seats and stuff like that. Just 435 in the House of Representatives and 100 in the Senate. So, give me my 100 right now. Let's match it. Where is it? I'm just really not feeling going back to school.
Me either.
No, it's not really working out for me, especially because we only have, like, 9 days left of each class. Like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Anyways, hello, everybody, and welcome to Not So Bloody Mary, the podcast where we talk about women in history with bad reputations, or, in this person's case, teenagers in history with bad reputations, because she never probably made it to adulthood.
That's so sad.
That is so sad. So, anyone that follows our TikTok probably guessed what we were doing, because I told you that my last TikTok was a clue to who we were covering today. So, we're going to be looking at Catherine Howard, our fave. She's probably only a year older than me when she became queen. So, that's really fun. That's not fun at all. But can you imagine having to be, like, queen, like, next year?
No.
I don't think I would be emotionally ready for that. I can't even handle, like, talking in front of my class.
Like, no. That's
being the role model for a whole country? No, thank you. Like, no. It would not work out for me. We would not be doing that. Mm-mm. But, so... You know, Catherine Howard is kind of, like, a mess and a half in terms of, like, her age. Because it's just really confusing and really complicated, and everybody has different opinions on how old she was. Like, right. Can we agree? But the thing is, Catherine Howard was born in the decade before the government made, like, mandatory, like, in the 1530s. Whenever you baptized a child, you had to make record of it and, like, put it in, like, the parish, like, the church. You had to be like, okay, today I baptized Edward Tudor. And then you have to put that in, like, you know, record somewhere so that if, you know, like, in 500 years, this was not why they did it, but in 500 years, a historian can go and look and be like, oh, okay, Edward was baptized on this day. But Catherine was born before that. So that's not great for her. The first recorded mention of her comes from a will. So her maternal great grandmother died, R.I.P. But like her maternal grandmother, Isabel Worsley. She died. She was her mother Joyce or whatever the heck her mom's name was. They called her like different things, but. This lady died and she left to Charles Howard, Henry, George, Margaret, Catherine Howard, 20 shillings each. I feel like that's, I don't know British money, so that doesn't seem like it's that much, but like, I'm sure it probably was a bit. Well, shillings aren't like crazy, but Charles Howard is, I think he's like the oldest one, but then like Henry, George, Margaret, Catherine, she's written as though she's like the youngest. And then the will, so it gets like, I don't know what probate means, but basically the will happened, before like the 26th of May, 1527. And it shows that Catherine had been born with time to spare for a younger sister by the spring of that year. So like her mom had to have some time of rest to, before she got pregnant again, I would hope. Whoop, bam, boom. But in Catherine's case, people suggest her birth date, literally, it's, like, almost 10 years that there's, like, a span. So suggestions have gone from 1518 to 1527. The promotion, like, of the first date, 1518, is mostly just, like, there's a portrait that people really wanted, like, Catherine to be the girl in this portrait. But she probably wasn't, so that's just where that date comes from, because they're like, oh my god, guys, yeah, she was born in 1518. I'm pretty sure that Catherine Parr was born in 1518, so I don't think so. She might have actually been born a few years before that, but, like, basically then. And support for the later years comes partly from the account of a Spanish merchant who was living in London late in Henry VIII's reign, and he described Catherine as a mere child at the time of her marriage in 1540. And, you know, 17 to them was not really a mere child, so.
Yeah.
Great. When combined with the evidence of the wills that, like, have her in them, Charles de Marillac, his indirect guess of about 1521 is when she was born, rules out a date as late as 1525. And the biographical details of the other maids of honor that she came to court with to serve Anne of Cleves also get rid of one as early as 1518, because she would be, like, really old compared to all the rest of them if she was born in 1518. Because maids of honor are supposed to be, like, the unmarried girls, so, mm-hmm. like, they would have married her off before then. So none of this is, like, definitive, but when you look at circumstantial evidence from Catherine's life and all that other stuff, it suggests 1522 or 1523 is the most probable years of her birth, which means that she was probably 19 when she died. Mm. Yeah, maybe 18, just because, like, her birthday could have been later in the year. Like, I mean, rip. It's not fun. Not fun at all. I have, like, scissors and I'm just, like, cutting paper because it's stressing me. Most accounts of Catherine's life say that her place of birth is a mystery, but regardless of where she was born, it's almost certain that it was in the town of Lambeth in the county of Surrey, which is just south of London. Basically, the Howards all kind of lived around there because that's just, you know, that's what they did. There was a bajillion of them. And Lambeth was the most logical place in Surrey to set up residence. I'm pretty sure that the son of the Duke of Norfolk was the Earl of Surrey. So, you know, that makes sense. But as if we look at her dad's finances, by the 1520s, he could only barely afford one establishment. So it's highly unlikely that she was born anywhere else than his house on Church Street. So her dad did not have very much money. He was kind of a gambler and not the best at keeping his money for his children, of which he had a lot. There's Dang. A lot of kids. So she did not have the best time because it's like, oh, she's a Howard. Well, yeah, she's a Howard, but her dad is the third son. So he gets like nothing from that. And then he also cannot keep any money. And she's like one of like 10 kids or something. No, not great. Thomas Howard. So his Catherine's dad, Edmund. Yes, his name is Edmund because he's really chill. Is the brother of Anne Boleyn's mother, Elizabeth. Because everybody's related. Just like, no. But their father, Thomas, they are supposed to, like, all these kids that he had a bunch of them. He had two wives, which isn't, like, that many. You know, Henry VIII had three times that. But, so he, I don't remember if it was him or I think, yeah, the family lost the Dukedom of Norfolk because they fought on the opposite side of Henry VII at the Battle of Bosworth. So that would be a no-no if you are a noble. And the king, like, Henry VII can't reward the people that fought on the opposite side of him. He's got to reward the people that are loyal to him so that they stay loyal to him. But now that their family has lost their dukedom, I do believe they still have kept their earldom. They had to, all his kids were supposed to do their part in rebuilding the family. So either through, like, royal service, good marriages, or both. And the most spectacular match that they had was the family's heir, Thomas married Henry the Seventh's sister-in-law, Anne of York. So that's his mom, like Henry VIII's mom, Elizabeth's sister, Anne. But she died in 1511. I don't think she was that old since Elizabeth was the eldest and she did not die very old. But Thomas then married Henry VIII's cousin, Lady Elizabeth Stafford, the younger sister of the Duke of Buckingham. So you'd got to think that, like, this person is somehow related to his first wife if this is Henry VIII's cousin. But whatever. It's fine. Then, yay, the Howards return to their dukedom. This is great for them. It's been 29 years since they lost it. But then Henry VIII restored their title in 1514 in recognition of Thomas Howard's leadership of the English forces at the Battle of Flodden. So if we remember the Battle of Flodden, that is the battle that Catherine of Aragon rode into when she was, like, prego. And she beat James of Scotland, who was Margaret Tudor's husband. And then wanted to send Henry his dead body, but the men were like, no, that's gross. And she was like, your weak English men wouldn't let me send the body, so I just sent the dead person's coat instead. Here.
Dang.
Yeah. She's a bit brutal. But yeah, Thomas Howard, now he's a duke again, so that's great. And he doesn't really show any snobbery towards his sons-in-laws like Thomas Boleyn, and they seem to have been promoted and patronized just like his own sons. And then in his old age, he retired from public life. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to be at court all the time if I was, like, 72. Like, I feel like that would be really gross, because court is kind of a bit of a mess. And he spent most of his time at the Castle of Framlingham, and then he died. So, R.I.P. to him. But I think he was, like, pretty old when he died. So, you know, I mean, sad, but, like, dying from old age isn't as bad as, like, being beheaded. Catherine had the bad luck to be born to a man who peaked long before he became a father. That is a quote from Gareth Russell's Young and Damned and Fair. He peaked in high school, basically. But they don't have high school, so.
Yeah.
He's just not great. Those people who knew him when he was younger described him as a courageous and a hearty, young, lusty gentleman. But he's not great. Gareth Russell again says, Edmund was a toxic combination of corrupt, unstable, and pathetic.
Oh.
So I don't think he likes him. He was one of 7 sons. So that's how many sons the Duke of Norfolk had. Henry VIII is so jealous right now. He has 7 sons, but he's the 3rd to reach adulthood. So he's the 3rd oldest. He was athletic like his father and brothers, but he didn't really have like their social awareness. He was not really good with people. So that's not great. At the Battle of Flodden, he was given command of the right flank with 3 subordinate knights serving as lieutenants over 1,500 men, which is a lot of men, mostly from Lancashire and Cheshire. Basically, they got attacked, and most of his men turned and ran away. So he was not a great leader, but he stayed. He stayed with, like, a handful of loyal servants, and he kept fighting. And apparently, he was struck to the ground on 3 separate occasions, but every single time he got back up and kept going. So, like, good job to him. Like, I mean, I think I would have also run away. I would not be good in battle. Edmund's life was saved by the arrival of cavalry who were headed by Lord Dacre. And then he got a knighthood, so he became a knight. That's good. I mean, 45 other people also became knights, but he's a knight now, so he's Sir Edmund Howard. And he's around 40, and he found a wife in Joyce Leigh or Lee. I think it's Lee. I'm really bad at pronouncing names. But her name is Joyce. So that's what we're gonna call her. She's a widow with 5 kids from her first marriage to another local official. The Howards tended to call her Jocasta, which is like a slightly grander name in their opinion. She's almost the same age as her new husband. So yeah, good for her. I mean, that's really refreshing that they're like the same age. But unfortunately, her first marriage, she was married at 12. So that's not great.
Oh.
And then when her father and her first husband died, they gave her a lot of money. Like, they left her with a lot of it. So her standing within the Lambeth community was pretty good, and her money was also good. Very useful to Edmund, since by 1514, there were signs that he was already accumulating debts. So, keep in mind that Catherine won't be born for, like, another, like, 7 or 8 years.
Oh.
Not great. But by the end of the 1520s, he was undeniably struggling with money. And very badly so, to the extent that he had to borrow heavily from his friends. And he couldn't get another job because it would bring great reproach and shame to him and all his blood, according to him. Because he's, like, too fancy for that. Which, I mean, I guess that kind of makes sense, but not great. His relatives' aid seems to have dried up between 1524 and 1531, a time when Edmund became increasingly desperate because he had a bunch of children. He asked Wolsey for money. There's like a full letter that survives, and I'm not going to read it all. I'm not going to read any of it because it's like really long, but basically you can see that like he's actually like he really needs help. It's kind of sad. But he didn't really get much help from Wolsey. He was the head of a really large household too, which did not help his financial problems. There were two older girls, Isabella and Margaret, who were from Jocasta or Joyce's first marriage, and then Catherine's full siblings, Charles, Henry, George, Margaret, and Mary, were all still living at home. So, like, that's a lot of kids if you don't have very much money.
Yeah.
Catherine's early life, obviously, from this, is not very easy to find any records of. She's one of the youngest in a really large family, and her dad is kind of not that important. Like, she has one of the most respected surnames in the country, but it, right away, it didn't really bring her anything in terms of material comfort or security. Her father was supposed to be one of the pillars of the local community, but in reality, he spent most of her childhood hiding from the people who were coming to take his money because he had debts, and resorting to increasingly desperate methods to get the money that they needed. We don't really know if her time in her dad's house was happy, but it was really short, so it didn't last very long. Her mother died in about 1528 or 1529, so she's not very old. She's like six. And her father got married like really fast to another widow, Dorothy Troyes. This marriage, too, seems to have been short because Dorothy's will was made in the early summer of 1530. But, so like a year later. That's not very good. By which point, Catherine's first cousin, Anne Boleyn, was firmly established at court as queen-to-be. Anne really liked to help out her relatives, like, if they needed help. She was, like, really into the fact that she had power, and so she could help people that needed help. And her relatives, some of them needed a lot of help. So Edmund needed a lot of help. And she actually, she's like, I'm going to find him a job. We're going to get him a job, guys. This is what is going to happen. The problem is that Anne gets good things, but they don't always work with the people that she's giving them to. Like, she doesn't really know him that well, so she just kind of gets any job she can. But she gives him the job of comptroller. And the post of comptroller has a lot of financial duties. So it's not really great for someone who's not very good with money. But he does become the comptroller of the port of Calais, and the decision is finalized on April Fool's Day, 1531. So, like, thanks, Anne. Good job. She's going to come in, like, one more time in this story. But that was her first appearance, her cameo appearance. I love how all the, like, all the six fans think that Anne and Catherine like knew each other. No, they didn't know each other. Catherine was one of like 50 different cousins that Anne had, and she was like 20 years younger than her. They did not know each other. Anne probably was aware when Catherine was born, and she probably knew that she kind of existed. Catherine definitely knew that Anne existed because, you know, she was queen. But like, they were not friends. No, they did not know each other. But at some point between April and December 1531, between the announcement of Edmund's new job and when he like actually went and took his duties, his household in Surrey was broken up. Two of the girls were married off, but Edmund's other children were old enough to begin being educated in someone else's house. So we don't know where the other people went, but Catherine, and at some unknown point, her brother Henry, went to live as wards of their wealthiest female relative, the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk. Fun. The Dowager Duchess is actually their step-grandmother. Oh. She's not their actual grandmother, because her dad came from the first batch of Norfolk children, and the Dowager Duchess is the second wife.
I see.
But yeah, Catherine was about 8 or 9 years old in 1531, and now she can actually get educated. So we don't really know how her education was happening before 1531. She could now expect to have private education through a set of tutors that were chosen by her grandmother, and their principal manor that they lived in was Chesworth House, and it was on the edge of Horsham Village. Great fun. Like most girls with a similar background, Catherine had grown up with servants, but there was like a massive amount of them at Chesworth, so it was probably kind of scary for a really small child. Widows did usually keep smaller households than a married nobleman, but like her dad had no money, so they probably didn't have very many servants. As Catherine, like, went down Chesworth's long corridors, there was a bunch of signs of her grandmother's fortune, like, everywhere. Her grandmother just, like, kept, like, a bunch of money in silver just casually at the house in case of an emergency. You know, as you do. I also keep silver in my house just in case of an emergency. It's definitely something that I do. Whenever they entered the Dowager's presence, they had to bow or curtsy and then repeat that action in miniature every single time she asked them a question. They had to curtsy again, or they just had to stand as still as a stone. They were not allowed to sigh, cough, or breathe too loudly in the lady of the house's presence. What does breathing too loudly mean? What if you have like a cold? You know when you have like a cold and you can't like breathe through your nose and you breathe really loud?
Yeah,
guess that can't happen. The Dowager Duchess of Norfolk was only 54 years old when Catherine first came into her house. She was the daughter of two gentry families from Lincolnshire, and she came to the late Duke's attention when his first wife, who was Agnes's relative, had passed away. Okay, then. Agnes's brother Philip, at the time, had been the Duke's steward, and even though he was almost 35 years older than her, the Duke was really, like, smitten with Agnes's charms, and he married her. Yeah, so she's Catherine's step-grandmother. That's great. I mean, now she gets to be, like, an independent woman until she dies with a lot of money, so that's fun. Even if Edmund hadn't gone to Calais, because, you know, he can't be in charge of her because he's in a different... Well, it's not a different country since Calais is still technically England's, but, like, it's across the channel. Catherine probably would have at some point found herself in the Dowager's household, because that's where they send all the girls, all the Howard girls. A bunch of them got sent there.
Yeah.
I mean, fun. It wasn't really just, like, her new home, but it was also her classroom and her finishing school, so it's basically, like, a boarding school. And sometimes it acts a bit like a boarding school, too. She was supposed to learn by example to behave like the great ladies of her family. And like the generation before her, she was taught that she had to have good manners, and etiquette was drilled into her at a very, very young age. Further, this is kind of Catherine's bread and butter. She's really into etiquette and doing things properly. For the rest of her life, she's very devoted to all those sorts of things. There's few things that ever seem to cause her greater stress or anguish or anxiety than the fear that she might make a mistake in public. And she barely ever did. Compliments on her polite gracefulness followed her into the grave. So that's great. Like, we know when she got executed, she wanted to have the block brought to her so that she could practice laying her head on it.
Yeah.
She seems like she has a lot of anxiety. I mean, same. But yeah, so she's like really, really afraid of making mistakes in public. Which, let's definitely put a teenager who's terrified of making mistakes in public as the leader of an entire court where all they ever do is watch for mistakes. That sounds great. No, it's not. Mm-mm. This decorum helped elevate Catherine, for while it kept her firmly like below her grandmother, it also affirmed her superior position to everyone else around her. Since the Victorian era, many writers have kind of said, oh, Catherine's childhood was so bad. It was like gilded neglect because she was cast adrift by a proud and heartless relative to live amongst a group of students who, servants who delighted in corrupting her. That's like, if you look closely at all the available evidence that survives from her life at Chesworth, it's really difficult to escape the conclusion that throughout her time she was there, she was treated differently to the other young people. Because she's initially only one of two people under the roof who's the granddaughter of a duke. So she's very important. In almost every single instance, she's in charge of her roommates. She confidently issues orders. She has access to all the chambers and all the keys of the mansion. If she or her brother Henry enters a room, all the servants are supposed to back away discreetly and, like, just kind of let them pass. Like, they are important. You got to be nice to them. The deference that she was shown throughout her childhood, even by the people that she counted as close friends, helped nurture her confidence and also her habit of giving commands to other people.
Right.
Yeah. One place where etiquette did relax and she was kind of just allowed to be was the maiden's chamber, which was the room where Catherine slept. It was basically like a dormitory, like if you went to a normal boarding school and there's like, you know, in movies where they have all like the beds lined up along the walls. That's basically what she slept in. Yeah. Certainly the maiden's chamber kind of made them all feel like really close together, but there was also a lack of privacy. Kind of like, you haven't ever been to sleepaway camp, but like, it's kind of like a cabin where there's no place to go to have privacy. So you just have to deal and figure it out. I mean, you could go to like the shower, but why would you want to do that? They're gross. Bedrooms were a really rare luxury in Tudor households. Sharing beds was very common, and sleeping in group accommodation was even more so. You know, as you do.
Of course.
In the maiden's chamber, she slept with other young women who were in her grandmother's care and her grandmother's service. Some of her friends, like Joan Ackworth, who is going to be a bit important, were a few years older, and others were the same age or a little bit younger. By the standards of many people at the time, Catherine enjoyed a youth that was very positive. It was not, even if it wasn't idyllic, it was certainly privileged, affectionate, and happy. She was really liked by most of the people at Chesworth. The servants really liked her. They're like, oh yeah, she's really sweet. She tried to help people a lot. She was always in high spirits. She was very generous, and she liked to have fun. She was a little bit mischievous, you know, as you do. R.I.P. to anyone who didn't have fun at that step-grandmother's house, because there was probably a lot of them, but whatever. In Catherine's case, there's no reason to believe that she endured an unhappy or neglected childhood once she went to her step-grandmother's household. We don't know what the heck was going on at Edmund's house. her Aunt Catherine, because there's no different names. Basically, her Aunt Catherine was married to some dude who, like, committed treason against Henry, I think. And then a whole thing, like, went around, and Anne Boleyn got Catherine, the aunt, remarried to a new husband because Catherine needed help. So this was like another instance to show her loyalty to her family was very valuable. It wasn't the same thing as like infallible. It wasn't always good, because she gave Edmund a job that he was not qualified for. And she gave Catherine a husband who she came to hate. But in difficult circumstances, Queen Anne was a worthwhile ally. Like, they all looked to her to be like, hello, Anne, we need help. Young Catherine was one of the dozens of the queen's cousins, nieces, aunts, uncles, and extended relatives who looked to her for advancement, especially in bringing them to court to serve her. So basically, they all kind of expect that eventually they will be brought to serve for Anne, as you do. Because the more Howards around Anne, the better, because they want people that are loyal to her to be serving her. Because, you know, things like Jane Seymour come along and make things not good.
Yeah.
But if it had been like one of Catherine's like sisters or something, then they probably wouldn't have done that, because their family is already in power because Anne is queen. They would have just been like a mistress or something. That's great. Even if she wasn't going to ever serve at the queen's side, Catherine still needed to continue to learn how to behave at court, because she wasn't going to spend her whole life at Chesworth House. She's a Howard. She's getting educated at the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk's house. She's not staying there her whole life. She's going to end up at some person's court, whether it's Anne's or, you know, Elizabeth's eventually. That's kind of like the vibe that they're getting. But then it's May 1536, everybody. So things don't happen great for the Howard family. It's like their worst defeat since their defeat at Bosworth. So that's not fun. Shortly after lunch, Queen Anne Boleyn was arrested and rowed upriver to the Tower of London, where 17 days later she died, after tucking the hem of her dress under her shoes, hoping to preserve her dignity once her body collapsed forward into the straw, which I think is really sad. She put, like, her hem under her shoes so that when her body, like, went limp, her, like, dress wouldn't ride up and she wouldn't expose herself.
Aww.
Honey. <That's> I know. In 17 days, the Howard women had been robbed of their most celebrated relative. And while it is tempting to think that the people at Chesworth spoke of Anne's fate in the same horrified, incredulous way that distant relatives like the Ashleys or the Champernowns seem to have done, it's equally possible that Catherine's friends discussed the events of 1536 with the same, you know, unthinkingly gleeful acceptance that greets so many political or royal scandals, no matter how improbable their details. The government's version of events that had Anne as a bed-hopping, murderous adulteress certainly made for a good story. If you think about it, this is basically, like, middle school.
Yeah.
These are all a bunch of middle school girls. Some of them are, like, high school age. Yeah, they're not going to be, like, poor Anne. Like, some of them might think that, but most of them are going to be like, did you hear how many men she was supposed to have slept with? Do you hear this? Do you hear that? Like, it's, they were probably, I would assume that they were probably a little sad and like, whoa, that's very sudden. But there's also probably a lot of, did you hear this? Did you hear that? Oh my God. They're like 12-year-old girls. It's what they do. They're 12-year-old girls are a treat. Yeah. If the family was not already nervous enough, within weeks of the Queen's execution, Catherine's younger uncle Thomas was also sent to the Tower. Because that's fun. And, you know, George also died when Anne died. So that was two Howard people who were executed. But Catherine's younger uncle is sent to the Tower because he got secretly betrothed to the king's niece, Lady Margaret Douglas. That is not okay. We don't do that. Because she's royal blood. So you have to ask help. Like, you have to be like, hey, Henry, can I marry your niece? And he has to say yes. The king is not in the best mood with the Howards at the moment since, you know, he thinks that the Norfolk and Boleyn kind of arranged what was going on with him and Anne. He's a bit mad at the Howards, and he thinks that the romance is part of a plot to put them closer to the throne again now that Anne is gone. So that's not good. But, yeah, so Thomas didn't get executed, but he did die in the Tower because he got sick. Because it's the Tower. It's not great in there. But Lady Margaret Douglas didn't die in there, so I guess that's good for her. She, actually, her grandson, it might be her great-grandson, was actually King James I of England, so fun.
Look at that.
Look at her go. Throughout the scandal caused by Thomas's elopement, the Pilgrimage of Grace Rebellion happened in the north of England. Yeah. Even a young girl like Catherine growing up in a country house in the south, which is not where the rebellion is happening, couldn't have missed the changes affecting England after the break with Rome. Catherine's family were actually initially sympathetic to the king's quarrel with the Pope, but by 1536, they were not. They didn't like it. Her family is one of the, like, very religious, very Catholic families because they're old. So I think they were not feeling the vibe. That's great. Okay, and now the gross stuff starts to happen.
Oh.
Yeah. So at this point, Catherine is about 13 or 14 years old. Sometime between her cousin's executions and her uncle's death. That's so sad. She began formal music lessons. I would like to say, though, she probably has a lot of cousins and a lot of uncles. But still. No. Yeah, so she started her formal music lessons. Uh-huh. 13 is kind of late to start the music lessons that most children in her position had been taking since age of, like, 6 or 7. So it is possible that she had had some lessons earlier, but Catherine's formal education when she was little does seem to have been kind of neglected by her dad. Unlike several of her relatives, she was never singled out for praise for her musical or literary abilities. Like, she's not really praised for being smart. By the autumn of 1536, her schooling focused on teaching her how to read, write, walk, talk, stand, dance, and move in a way that would please everyone around her, but not really anything else. Her principal music teacher, was a young man called Henry Mannix. He was brought in by the Dowager Duchess, possibly on the recommendation of his relative Robert Damport, who was already in her service. Mannix wasn't really far off the stereotype of, like, an arrogant, young, emotionally impulsive musician, you know, like all those e-boys that make Spotify music now. You know who I'm talking about. He kind of set the mold for the type of man that Catherine was drawn to for the rest of her life. Handsome, cocky, more brawn than brain, and passionate to the point of creepily possessive. That's great. Several of Catherine's friends had already had kind of like romantic things going on with the young gentleman of the household. Because as with most establishments before the late 17th century, women were in the minority on the Dowager staff. So there's like way more men. So now they're basically like beginning high school. She's like 13, 14. My brother will be starting high school and he's 13. That's kind of where they are. And, you know, those people are not smart. Sorry, Cooper, but it's the truth. Y'all are annoying. Mannix is probably like in his 20s, but I don't think we actually know how old he was, because he's not really that important of a person, so why would they make note of his baptism?
No clue.
No idea. Catherine and Mannix began a flirtation that eventually progressed to kissing and fondling. In kind of like nowadays talk, they fooled around, like they hooked up, kind of, but they didn't go all the way, so they did not round all the bases. So I guess that's good. She began her lessons with Mannix and Barnes, that's the other music guy, in 1536. The attraction between Catherine and Mannix seems to have been relatively like slow burning, but eventually the couple, it's, you know, it's a fanfic, slow burn, 100,000 words. Those are like the best kind. But eventually the couple began to send each other small gifts. I don't know where they found these gifts, but they started buying them and sending them to each other. That's great. A young maid called Dorothy Barwick was the first to carry tokens on Catherine's behalf. Like, they sent them back and forth to each other. Mannix later said that he fell in love with Catherine and she fell in love with him. That was not how other people remembered it. More honestly, he and Catherine found each other very attractive. And the taboo kind of nature of their affair, since, you know, he's her music teacher, and also he is not her status. They have a big difference in class. He is a music teacher, and she is the granddaughter of a duke. You know, not the same thing. So they've got, like, a certain kind of spice to it. It feels, like, taboo and dangerous. It's like the bad boy that your parents are like, please don't date him.
Love that.
Yeah, to meet up alone and outside their lessons would have required a lot of skill, of subterfuge. Catherine did not bring Mannix into her shared dormitory because, you know, we get lots of stuff about how all these relationships went down because they were questioned a lot about them when she was arrested. But Catherine never brought him into the room that everybody else was in. So where they found the time and the place to progress along the basis of physical intimacy is really anybody's guess. No one really knows. They just kind of found the time. They had been perhaps meeting on several occasions when the Dowager Duchess found them kissing in an alcove near the chapel one afternoon. Not what they were supposed to be doing. Nuh-uh-uh. She slapped Catherine 2 or 3 times. Because as you do. And reiterated that they were never to be left alone together. She's like, no, they're not let them alone together. They did not obey her. They did not listen. Besties. Oh my God. Okay, like, she's like 14, though. That's kind of how 14-year-old girls are. You're like, don't do that. They're like, okay, so I'm going to do it even more.
Yeah.
They didn't listen, but they at least did have the sense to become more discreet. It was still an open secret to most of the other people at Chesworth, but they did hide their relationship from the Dowager Duchess. Which, I don't know if that's good or not. Maybe if she'd seen them again, she would have sent him away. But, yeah. They were still seeing each other in early 1538, so it's been like 2 years. Well, not 2 years, like a year and a half. when a young woman called Mary Lascelles arrived to serve in the household on like a regular basis. She was working as a nursemaid to one of Catherine's infant cousins when the child's father, Lord William Howard, who is the Dowager Duchess's youngest surviving son, began to spend more time in his mother's household. Tudor house guests sometimes stayed longer than modern tenants, like people who rent houses. They just kind of stayed for really long time, like they didn't leave. So their servants ended up living and serving alongside the owners. I feel like I'd be like, can you get out of my house? Like, what are you doing here? But I'm sure that this house was kind of like massive, so it was okay. Mary the nursemaid was a very prim young girl from a family who took the Reformation very seriously, and she was horrified about what she heard about her master's niece. Two fellow maids, Isabel and Dorothy, admitted to her that they had been carrying messages and love tokens from Catherine to Mannix. Yeah. So Mary kind of seems like she doesn't think that it is not okay because Catherine is like 14 and he's like 20, because it's 1538, but she thinks that he can't be with Catherine because she's like way higher status than him. I feel like she would be the girl that everyone would bully, because they were like too prim. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So Mary's concerned, and she reaches out, and she's like, it's just solidarity where servants were, like, standing together. She reaches out to Mannix to warn him of the danger that he's in. She's like, no, you can't marry Catherine if you have any plans to do that. That's impossible, because she is from a noble house, and if thou should marry her, some of her blood would kill thee. Basically, if you marry her, her family's gonna murder you. Uh-huh. Mannix was kind of mad. He was like, hold thy peace, woman. I know her well enough. And then he says some gross things. He explains, I have had her by the C-U-N-T, and she hath said to me that I shall have her maidenhead, though it be painful to her, not doubting, but I will be good to her hereafter. I don't know if the C word was, I'm not going to say it on this podcast, but I don't know if it was like a swear back then. It's not a swear word in Australia right now, but, like, it still kind of seems really crude. Mannix's boast shot through the gossip network of the house. It ends up right to Catherine, who is not exactly happy when she hears what Mannix had said about her. So she's about 15 or 16, so she's about our age, and she's like, no. she ends their relationship. Even though Mannix is like, I'm so much in love with you that I don't know what I said. I'm so sorry. And she's like, buddy, I'm unimpressed. This is not happening. They have a fight. During their argument, she points out, I will never be not with you and able to marry me, ye be not. This comment is usually interpreted by historians as an example of snobbery on Catherine's part to remind him, like, you're way less than me, so you can't marry me. Had Catherine meant to make that point, she would have been unkind, but she would have been accurate. But in fact, it actually kind of seems that she was being more specific. Mannix couldn't marry her because he was already engaged to someone else or already married. Okay, buddy, you're not Henry VIII. Like, not that important. If Catherine did intend to lose her virginity to Mannix, his comments about her and his fiancé gave her the motivation to end things before they went any further. All of her life, Catherine hated to be humiliated. Comes again with that hates to mess up in public. She hates being humiliated. And she reacts very strongly when she is faced with disrespect or embarrassment. So, honestly, same. I think that we would either hate each other or be really good friends. A few days after they broke up, Catherine softened and agreed to hear Mannix out one last time. The two went for a walk in the Duchess's orchards. Mannix seems to have mistaken this as a sign that their relationship might be back on track, but it was only being polite on Catherine's part. Her mood had gotten better, but her mind was made up. And not long after that, she found a replacement for Mannix in the form of Frances Dereham, her grandmother's secretary. No. No thank you. Why are all these men in positions of power? Men are gross. Catherine, now we're going to talk about what she looked like for a hot second. Catherine conformed to general contemporary ideals of beauty, which praised women who had moistness of complexion, which I don't know what the heck that means, but I'm pretty sure it's, like, pale. And are tender, small, pliant, and fair of disposition of body. Contrary to the still-repeated tradition that Catherine was small, plump, and vivacious, the few surviving specifics about her appearance describe her as short and slender. So she's kind of, like, small. A former someone who was at court described her as flourishing in youth with beauty fresh and pure. She was comfortable with admiration and attention, like she got a lot of it. Mannix was not the only servant who was kind of in love with her. There was also a young man named Roger Coates. So she's good looking. I mean, she has to be because Henry VIII fell in love with her. And it doesn't really seem like she, like, got a lover, but like Catherine of Aragon was, you know, she's got that whole forbidden thing at the beginning, and then she's also like a really good queen, so I think that's kind of where that came from. Anne Boleyn's mind won him over. Jane Seymour's boringness won him over. It's true though, she was like the opposite of Anne Boleyn, and that won him over. And then Anne of Cleves did not win him over. Sorry babe, but it's true. And then Catherine Howard didn't really, she just was really pretty, and he was like, I like that. R.I.P. As she got older, Catherine was giving she got servants of her own. She's like that important now. They're like, here's your own servants, Catherine. She gets her roommate, Joan Ackworth, as her secretary. How much correspondence she actually had at this stage in her life is unknown, since she's like 16. Who is she writing letters to?
No. Yeah.
But it's clearly not enough to create a crushing workload for Joan. Like, Joan is not kept busy at all. It was through her secretary that Catherine found Mannix's successor. Francis Dereham was good-looking, confident to the point of arrogance, and a rule-breaker who possessed a blazing temper, which Catherine initially chose to regard as thrilling proof of his affection for her. Kind of sounds like Henry VIII a little bit. Does she have a type? Yes. He was also a ladies' man. He had already notched his bedpost with several fellow servants, including her secretary, Joan Ackworth. No. Their little fling had since ended, and Joan moved on perfectly fine. She's like, whatever. She even sang his praises to Catherine, who began to show an interest in him in the spring of 1538, at the very most within a few weeks of ending things with Mannix. Okay. Whatever, honey. Do what you want. By then, Francis had been in the Dowager's service for almost 2 years. He was distantly related to Catherine and the Dowager Duchess, and he was the son of a wealthy family in the Lincolnshire gentry. The Dowager was very fond of him, and he eventually carried out secretarial work for her. Okay, one of Francis's closest friends in the household was his wingman, Edward Waldegrave. What a name. Who gamely chased the friends of Francis's lovers and helped organize nighttime visits to the maiden's chamber. They would show up with wine, apples, strawberries, and other things that they would steal from the kitchens. Okay. Honestly, this kind of sounds fun. Like, low-key, I think I'm just so starved for, like, friends and hanging out with people.
Literally.
They would talk and drink and flirt until the small hours in the morning. It's like, sometimes like 3 o'clock in the morning. And if anyone from downstairs came to inspect unexpectedly, there was a small curtained gallery at the end of the maiden's chamber where the men could hide until the danger had passed. And the idea to hide them in there was Catherine's. Great job, hon. I mean, she like helped her friends out. To make the numerous rendezvous easier, Catherine took the initiative and sneaked into her grandmother's room one evening, stole the key, had a copy made, and then ensured the door to the suitcase, that a staircase that led to the maiden's chamber was unlocked after the dowager went to bed. So, I'm sure that they all loved her for that. Good job, Catherine. Totally. Within a couple of months of seeing Dereham, the reluctance Catherine had expressed to Mannix about losing her virginity had evaporated. She and Francis began lying on her bed during the parties. This progressed to kissing, foreplay, and then eventually they did sleep together. It's great. I mean, she's like 16. Do what you want. But he's also, like, old. I don't know how old he was, I will be honest. But it's still gross. There wasn't much privacy in the maiden's chamber, but Catherine was, like, according to her, so far in love that it did not seem to deter her. One of the Dowager's maids, Marjorie, who later married another servant in the household, called John Bonnet, spied on them and saw Francis removing Catherine's clothes. Later, Francis told Marjorie that he knew enough about sex to make sure that Catherine did not end up pregnant. So I guess that's good. That would not be great for her. Also, we wouldn't be talking about her if she had ended up pregnant.
Yeah.
I mean, that probably would have been good for her because, you know, she wouldn't have died at, 19. But she wouldn't have been queen. Before the Dowager arrived at her pew for morning mass, her servants gathered the usual pile of letters that were left there, like, to petition her to be like, ma'am, I need money. After a service at Lambeth, one of the notes brought her a nasty surprise. It claimed that if the Dowager went up to the maiden's chamber half an hour after her usual bedtime, you shall see that which shall displease you. The Dowager went up in a rage. She was, like, really mad. And only through sheer luck did the girls manage to hide the worst of what was happening from her. So, good job, girls, I guess. Like, I don't know. In any case, the Duchess did not discover that Catherine was seeing Dereham. The note was, like, kind of opaque enough for the Dowager to think that it referred to another young man called Hastings, whose flirtatious interest in one of Catherine's roommates had already been noticed. Catherine did not think that the tip referred to Hastings, and she was mad. She was like, oh my god, I could have been embarrassed. I could have been humiliated. So she broke into the Dowager's rooms again, stole the letter, and took it straight to Francis, who agreed that Henry Mannix must have written it, perhaps with the help of one of his friends. He's supposed to have been, like, jealous of her, so he, like, wrote this because he was mad that she and Francis were hooking up. Buddy, just, like, go to your wife and be quiet. Like, oh my god. Well, Catherine Francis did get saved from the worst of her relatives' suspicions. They were so obviously obsessed with each other that the Dowager eventually noticed. She might have actually been the last person in the house to know. Even John Walshman, her elderly porter, realized before she did. He's like an old man and he knows. Years of being told to look at Catherine, to watch her, and to defer to her meant that almost everyone in the household knew exactly what their mistress's granddaughter was doing. I don't think I would like that very much. I think that would make me really uncomfortable. Everyone knew what I was doing all the time. But since, like, it just doesn't sound fun. Since aristocratic households kept secrets with the same amount of discretion as a modern high school, perhaps what was most remarkable about Catherine's summer romance of 1538 was that nobody else tried to inform the Dowager about it after Mannix's botched attempt to exact revenge. Catherine, in this case, benefited from the affection she inspired in many of those around her, so everyone likes her, so they don't really want to get her in trouble. Although, there were some people who did not care for her, like Mary Lascelles, but they were too afraid to spill her secrets to the Dowager because they're not powerful enough. But then Catherine and Francis, they aren't being smart about hiding this thing, you know? Not working out for them. The Duchess's suspicions were confirmed one afternoon when she walked in on Catherine and Francis wrapped in each other's arms. Not good. She was talking to Joan Ackworth, who was supposed to have been acting as Catherine's chaperone. So it kind of, like, makes me think of in movies, like, when someone's, like, guarding the door and then the person that isn't supposed to be there just, like, shows up and just, like, starts walking in. So they, like, keep running to talk to them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't work. The last time that she had caught Catherine in an embrace, the Dowager had slapped her. This time, she punched Catherine, Francis, and Joan and then launched herself into a tirade. Eventually, the Dowager did calm down, and she contented herself with comments that went from really pissed off to just kind of slightly pissed off to accepting and finally to amusement. When people asked where Francis was, she replied with comments that were like, I warrant if you seek him in Catherine Howard's chamber, ye shall find him there. The fact that Dereham, like Mannix before him, was able to keep his job was a poor reflection on the Dowager's position as a guardian. Properly, he would have either been dismissed or Catherine would have been sent to stay with another relative until the infatuation had passed. That is how we are supposed to do these things. When Elizabeth Tudor and Thomas Seymour had their little creepy sexual assault thing on Thomas's part, Catherine Parr sent her away. That's what we're supposed to do. Like, no, besties. Like, she couldn't send Thomas Seymour away. He was her husband, so she sent Elizabeth away. Agnes might have failed to act out of a desire to avoid embarrassment for herself, because if she, like, you know, How can she explain the problem without being like, yeah, I didn't watch them properly? She was anxious that none of the other girls would breathe a word about it to Catherine's Uncle William and confided in these worries to her chaplain, Father Burrow. For quite some time, she seemed to believe, or chose to believe, that it was only a mutual crush that would soon blow over. Oh my. Catherine Tilney, who slept in the maiden's chamber, stated later and stood by her testimony, the Dowager Duchess never knew the relationship had been consummated or that there was talk in the house of the couple making it to the altar. So the Dowager Duchess just really isn't on top of things. She does not know what's going on in her house. Frances encouraged the idea of a wedding. When a friend asked him, a friend was like, hey, are you going to marry her? Frances was like, yeah. The gifts passing between the couple took on a domestic character. Catherine gave him bands and sleeves for a shirt. At New Year's, he gave her the gift of a heartsease, which is like, it's a flower made out of silk, which actually sounds really pretty. It was like really important to her. She really liked this little silk thing. Mm. Deering was with her almost constantly. They nicknamed each other husband and wife. And he lounged, he would always, like, be in the maiden's chamber, just on people's beds, just sitting there talking to her. And he would constantly bring up the question of marriage. She was still very careful to keep the details from her grandmother. She wouldn't wear the silk flower until she persuaded a family friend, Lady Eleanor Brereton, to tell the dowager that she had given the bauble to Catherine as a gift. She's like, just tell my grandmother if she asks that you gave it to me. And she's like, okay, sure. The silk flower was a token that Catherine really liked, and she wanted more. Her love of clothes and fashion was a kind of a big deal. She really liked that. Although, like most unmarried girls from the same background, she didn't really have any money of her own. So, yeah. She had enough pocket money to go to Mrs. Clifton, who was a housewife in Lambeth, who embroidered for her one of Francis's shirts that he received as a present from the Dowager at New Year's. When Frances told her about a lady in London who was supposed to be a skilled needlewoman, she was so excited to get some pieces that Frances was like, yeah, I'll buy you another silk flower. And she was like, yeah. At a later date, he also bought her the fabric she wanted to make a new headdress. He considered it a gift, but Catherine wanted to pay him back. Basically, he does have money because, you know, he's working as a secretary, so he does get paid. She does not because she's just living there. She took the cloth to Mr. Rose, who was her grandmother's embroiderer. She trusted in his good taste, and she wasn't really interested, probably, in the precise details beyond getting the right color and fabric. She didn't give him specific instructions beyond what kind of hat she wanted. When it was ready, she regretted her lack of specification. Frances loved the friar's knots, which were symbols of constant love that Rose had stitched into it, but Catherine was not in the same boat. She really wasn't for it. She was starting to withdraw from him. She's not really, like, feeling it anymore. He was, like, at first he was all, like, attentive and stuff, and she thought that was really cool because, like, he was all protective over her, but now it just feels like he's being possessive. At the beginning when he got mad, she's like, oh my gosh, he's defending me. Now it just seems like it's really irritating. He just is a lot, and she doesn't like it anymore. He doesn't have any appeal for her anymore. To his frustration, she wouldn't give him a firm answer about a wedding. She kind of stopped calling him husband, and she tried to slow down his, he really wanted to get married, and she's like, no thanks, sorry. At the time, a pre-contract referred to a commitment between two people who were pledged to marry at a later date. With it in place, many couples began to sleep together, partly because of the belief that sex created a bond as unbreakable as marriage. So as far as Frances was concerned, he and Catherine were bound to each other, but it seems that she did not view the situation in the same way. I mean, sucks for you, Frances Deering. Don't really feel that bad. Then her dad died. I don't really know how sad she would have been since he hasn't been in her life for like 9 years. But you know, now she's an orphan, so that's not very fun. And the responsibility to find her a good position in life is now even more on the other Howards. Luckily, an opportunity presented itself, which would also have the added advantage of getting her away from Frances Deering. Her Uncle William had been involved in several missions abroad to scout eligible princesses for Henry VIII. By summer 1539, He was pretty sure that the Queen's household was going to be revived to serve the Duke of Cleves' younger sister, Anne, who would arrive in England for her wedding within the year. So they're like, oh my God, this is perfect. The Queen's household is like the best place for a well-bred young girl, especially because Catherine still needs a husband, because when she's there, she's going to see all the most eligible men in the country. Catherine's uncle Norfolk sends word to Norfolk House that Catherine had been selected to join the court as a maid of honor. That's really, that's very, like, very good job, because it's not the easiest to get that position. And she's, like, excited. She's really interested in court. She's like, guys, this is going to be the best thing ever. And also, this fantastic new thing that's, like, this new opportunity is giving her the push that she needs to break things off with Francis. Now they can break up. As with Mannix, they talk things over in the orchard at Lambeth. So I guess that's just where she takes everyone to break up with them. It's her place. Francis claimed later that Catherine was crying hysterically, and she's like, I'm so sorry. I just have to obey what my family tells me to do. But in her memory, she got mad at him. She lost her temper at his numerous questions about his future. She replied to him that he might do as he wanted because his plans were no longer her concern. Yeah. Both versions of their conversation may contain some element of truth. Perhaps Catherine was crying and seeing how upset he was. It was, like, it's entirely possible to feel grief for a relationship that you still want to end. Like, just because you break up with someone doesn't mean that you're not sad about breaking up the relationship.
Yeah.
The hesitation or mixed emotions resulted in another failure to drive the point home. So Frances doesn't get that they are broken up. She didn't really make it clear to him that she considered this a permanent goodbye. Nor did she state firmly that she had never considered their talk of marriage to constitute a binding pre-contract. Francis still believed that there was a chance that he would one day be Catherine's husband. And this will come back to bite her in the butt. But she's going to court. Yay! And that is where we're going to enter, because she is having an exciting opportunity opening up in front of her face. And that's really great for her. She deserves it. I just wish that what happened when she went to court didn't happen.
Yeah.
But it's great that she's getting away from the Dowager Duchess's house.
Yes.
Sorry, Agnes. You did not run a tight ship at all. So, that's the end. We will have a mini-sode probably coming out next weekend. I mean, I also am doing lifeguarding stuff all next weekend from 9 to 6 both days. So who knows what will happen.
We will see.
I will probably try and get something. I mean, I have English all week. So sometimes in English class, I have no desire to do anything else after I'm done. But it makes me want to choke. But you should go follow us on all of our social medias, except for Twitter, because I don't use it. So I feel like we should just give up. But you could follow us on Twitter if you wanted. It's not bloody underscore dot or something, just search up Not So Bloody Mary in like the little search bar and it should come up. You should follow us on Instagram at Not So Bloody Mary underscore podcast. We don't post a lot on there. I mostly just post about the new episodes that we put up, but then you can stay notified on when they've been put up. And you should go follow us on TikTok, because that is where we post the most. I post at least once every day.
Follow on TikTok there. It's very funny.
It is a great TikTok. Yeah, honestly, though, like, we've got a lot of people that have come over from TikTok. So if you're here from TikTok, thank you for coming over and welcome. We're really fun. But yeah, we've got a lot of followers in like the last week. So it's very great to have all of you coming to listen if you're here. You should also go follow Grace at the lovely underscore bookworm. Wait, the lovely underscore bookworm?
Yes.
Yeah.
You like book stuff.
If you like book stuff, she doesn't post very much.
Okay, I'm stressed.
She like never posts. She did change her profile picture.
I did. Do you know so what that's from?
Is it from Sheera?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so you're like in glass. But Henry's trying to get me to watch Sheera now. I promise.
Does Henry watch it?
Yeah. Talk to him. Just text him about it. Yeah, he's trying to get me to watch it because, yeah, But I told him that I'm watching Julie and the Phantoms right now. We'll work on it.
You need to watch Shira. So you listen to Henry? You're not going to watch Shira because of me?
No. I'm watching Julie and the Phantoms because of you, miss.
You're watching Julie and the Phantoms because you're podcast people. Don't lie.
That is not true. They don't talk about it enough. If they did a podcast on it, I would probably listen to it, though. Lena and Ian, I love you. You don't listen to this at all. Definitely not. This is not their cup of tea. They listen to D&D podcasts.
I love that.
I did listen to Julie. I did watch Julie and the Phantoms because you told me to.
You hate it.
I don't hate it. I thought that the girl, the performance at the, like, the pep rally with the girl that, the mean girl that you think is Little Miss Perfect did with, like, the Katy Perry choreographer or whatever, it was really good.
I know!
It was actually, like, really good, but the people in the background looked like actual adults, and I was like, oh my.
Wait, what episode are you on?
Episode 3, but there was one girl that looked like an actual teenager that wasn't the main girl, but the rest of them looked really old, and I was like, oh, they were very good dancers, though. Like, good job. Pop off. But yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what we're doing right now. Mike and Rachel are gonna leave Suits really soon. I'm not there for it. We're doing great, in case you were wondering, everybody.
So great.
So great. You should not go follow my TikTok because I'm on the podcast TikTok. That's my face all the time. Yeah, Grace did comment, and then someone liked that. Someone liked that comment. I was like, guys, this is Grace. So
this is me.
Like, guys, go follow. But yeah, so we're really fun. And the massive photo of Catherine of Aragon that I have in my room is staring at me. So we're gonna end this because she's kind of creeping me out, and I need to get out of my room. She's just, like, always there.
Love that.
I don't know why I printed it out. I printed it out for a TikTok for our podcast account. And then I didn't really want to throw it out because I kind of felt bad about just, like, throwing her in the trash.
Yeah.
Since that's kind of what Henry did to her. I didn't think she deserved it again. Anyways, we're just having a really good time.
So good.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Grace, wait, what are they going to do today? Are they going to go watch? Oh,
you guys are going to go watch She-Ra on Netflix and report back to me.
It's five seasons long.
Okay, if you can't watch She-Ra, go to YouTube and watch The Owl House. It's one season.
Yes, it is. Everyone should also go watch Dickinson. Grace, the next time I see you, we can watch more Dickinson.
Yes.
And more tutors. I feel like the next time we see each other, we need to, like, see each other for, like, an entire day.
Or, like, a week, so I can watch all your TikToks, because they're going to be, like, so long. So long.
Yeah, but, like, we need, like, more than just, like, the normal, like, 3 hours that our parents give us, because we haven't seen each other in, like, 2 months.
Like, a few runs.
So I think that they should let us have an entire day.
Maybe when I'm vaccinated.
That's just my opinion. Well, you're getting vaccinated on Tuesday.
Yes, I am.
So, yeah, guys, I'm vaccinated now. Grace will be soon. So,
woo.
Not fully vaccinated because we live in Ontario.
Half vaccinated.
So, that's fun. Peace out, home slices.
Bye.
Y'all are chill. Bye.